the news came as something of a shock that Margaret Thatcher died at the beginning of this week, and the newspapers reported it like this: fatal stroke, aged 87. Now, some of the people were dancing in the street shouting, "The witch is dead," and there was a lot of very uncouth, crude behavior of people who were very hostile to Margaret Thatcher. I had somebody send me an email saying, "I hated her back then, I hate her now, I hope she burns in hell. She did more damage to British industry than the Luftwaffe. I loathe Thatcher," and I wondered, what's he doing on our emailing list? But there's a lot of hatred for this woman. And you can imagine why, because the media didn't like her, because she's countercultural. She was not going the way of socialism. She was going the way of free enterprise. She wasn't going with the politically correct. She was going in the politically incorrect direction. This is how the Spanish press in Argentina depicted her, as a pirate. So the Daily Mirror, which is known as pretty communist in Britain, brought this out this week, Tuesday this week. The woman who divided a nation. Should she really be given a funeral ceremony like Princess Diana? So there's still hostility to her in Britain. But what is the real story? What are the facts behind the life of Baroness Margaret Thatcher, who has been known as the Iron Lady? It is a fact. Margaret Thatcher was one of the most extraordinary and one of the most successful leaders in British history. She is the first female prime minister, not just in England, she is the first female prime minister in Europe. Margaret Thatcher embodied principled decisiveness and moral absolutism. She championed the rights of the individual versus the rights of the state. In 1987, she famously declared, "There's no such thing as society. When you say society must do this and society must do that," she said, "There is no society. There are individuals and there are families. And we must take personal responsibility for our own needs and for the needs of our family, and we must be gracious and compassionate to our neighbours. But there's no society out there that owes you anything, and there's no society that's going to do your work for you. You must carry your own burdens, and you must help others carry theirs, starting with your own family and helping any neighbours." And so she said, forget disciplines of society, this and society that. It's not society's fault, it's your fault. The Soviet press nicknamed her the Iron Lady, because in 1976, when she was the head of the Conservative Party, but still in opposition, she made a famous speech saying the Russians are bent on world domination, which you would think is a fact, but they tried to suggest that she was the Iron Lady trying to fight against Soviet communism. She took that insult as a badge of honor. Margaret Thatcher later enjoyed a close working relationship with American President Ronald Reagan, and both of them survived assassination attempts early on in their careers. The life and political career of Margaret Thatcher was packed full of drama, packed full of confrontation, extraordinary resolution. I hope that one day they make a really good, honorable film based on the facts on her life and some of the things she dealt with, because it's excellent material for that, not this disgraceful abuse of celluloid that Hollywood came out with recently. She faced the miners' strike that just about shut down the country. She dealt with the Falklands War. She faced the IRA bombing campaign on the British mainland, including the bombing of her hotel room at the Conservative Party Congress in Brighton, and she only missed death by a hairbreadth. It was seconds before the bomb went off. She just walked out of the bedroom into the bathroom as the bomb exploded, took out the whole section where her bedroom had been. If she had been in there, she would not have survived. There were four of the people in the cabinets there who were killed in this bombing, and Margaret Thatcher only escaped by God's grace. She led Britain during the height of the Cold War, during the climax of the Cold War. Margaret Thatcher was born on 13th of October 1925 in the eastern English town of Grantham. That's Margaret Thatcher on the left, her elder sister on the right. She took pride in a modest working class background. She's called the grocer's daughter, often in derision, but she is proud of the fact that she is a grocer's daughter.
Some grocer.
Indeed. And here's the shops. Roberts, which is not in the grocery store, but was also the post office, many things together. And that's where she learnt a good work ethic. As she entered politics at age 20, and was running for office already at age 20, although she didn't get elected until she was 25. She studied chemistry at Oxford, and she became involved in politics at a very young age. Here you can see at age 25 at a successful candidacy where she is elected, Margaret Roberts, the Conservative candidate. And that's the picture that the press published. She gave her first political speech at age 20. Her husband, Dennis, stood by her the whole way through, and he was most supportive. She was elected leader of the Conservative Party in 1975 when they were in opposition, while the Labour was wrecking the country and trying to destroy Rhodesia at the same time. Her party was in opposition. Britain was in terrible decline. 4 years later, she made history when she became the first female Prime Minister in British history, leading the Conservatives to victory in the elections of 1979, and that was only the first of three elections in which she led the Conservatives to victory. And here's how the Daily Telegraph placed it. 43 majority for first woman Prime Minister. And she takes over, indeed. This would have been where the fighting took place, in the House of Commons. And the House of Lords is red upholstery, the House of Commons is green upholstery. And the Prime Minister always sits to the left of the Speaker, facing the Speaker. Would be on the left, so actually on the right of the Speaker. She became the Prime Minister of a United Kingdom that was incredibly divided at that time. The government was facing bankruptcy, unemployment was escalating, the labour unions were paralysed in the country with strikes. Margaret Thatcher successfully turned the country around by cutting social welfare programmes, reducing trade union powers and privatising major industries. She offered a bold plan to reverse Britain's economic decline and to reduce the role of the state in the economy. She did not have a political program as much as a philosophy. When you read her book, to her everything was according to the principles that had to be applied. It was all a matter of principle. It wasn't a matter of what is politically expedient. It wasn't a matter of what was popular. It wasn't what is good and what is right for the country. And she said, a patient may not like the treatment, but if you know what is required, as a good doctor, you must go through with the treatment. And plainly, Britain had become bloated with inefficient state bureaucracy. It had become lazy. It had lost its work ethic. Britain was in a mess, and it had been in decline since the beginning of the century, as she pointed out. And her solution was radical, and she was determined to go ahead, whether it was popular or not. Concerning socialism, Margaret Thatcher famously declared, the problem with socialism is that sooner or later they run out of other people's money. Early in her prime ministership, Margaret Thatcher demonstrated a determination to use decisive military action during the 1980 siege of the Iranian embassy in Princes Gate in London. Now, for the first time in 70 years, the armed forces were authorised to use lethal force on the British mainland. 26 hostages were being held by 6 gunmen. When Prime Minister Thatcher authorised the Special Air Service to storm the embassy, it was a time when many embassies, over 40 embassies, were seized and held in 1980, including most famously the American embassy in Iran. And this is the location close to the Royal Albert Hall of Kensington Road, the Iranian embassy. Of course, remember, Iran under the Shah had been a Western ally, but he had been betrayed by Jimmy Carter's government very duplicitously into the hands of these radical Muslims. Here's SAS soldiers in civilian clothes providing backup support from the road. As the main assault force came in by helicopters, abseiled down from the roof, and you can see with their German Heckler & Koch MP5 9mm submachine guns and all their different paraphernalia bursting in, blowing out the windows. Here's one of the hostages fleeing, and police on the side taking hostages into protective custody as they managed to escape. This was done for the first time anyone saw an SS operation full light of the world's media, as they came in with their gas masks and they tossed in tear gas in order to and stun grenades in order to immobilize the attackers. You can see on the side the spare magazines for the Heckler & Koch. And one of the points was just before attacking, cut all the electricity so that everyone inside the wood behind curtains, so that they would have a disadvantage. They're coming in, they're throwing in stun grenades, they've got lights, the attackers are in darkness, and speed was the key element. So Margaret Thatcher showed how to do it. The siege busters. They freed 19, they killed all five of the terrorists holding the hostages, and they got all the hostages out alive. A real success story. And this at a time when no other government in the West had the nerve to carry out such an assault. Jimmy Carter didn't do anything like that to save the Americans, held for 444 days in the American embassy in Iran, nor did any of the other Western governments who were being held hostage by terrorists. And so she showed the way. Lady Thatcher also had to deal with the ongoing Irish Republican Army, IRA terrorism, which increasingly targeted the British mainland. Ireland has got a Protestant North and a Catholic South. And when the Irish erupted in revolution in 1916, while the British were preoccupied fighting for some obscure reason in Europe, they managed to storm Dublin's post office, take it over. They initiated a civil war. Well, the English had had enough, and they actually promised the whole of Ireland independence as soon as the war was over. Well, the Protestants then rose up in revolt and said, we will be part of Britain, we are not Catholic, and we are not Irish in the sense of the Irish and South. We are Scots-Irish, we are Picts, we came through from Scotland, and the North is racially more Scottish than Irish, even though they're called Northern Ireland, they're actually Scots-Irish, to be more accurate. But they are British. They are loyal to the Queen. They are Unionists or Loyalists. And so they threatened to fight Britain to get in, to stay as part of Britain. They would not be put into a common island. And so Britain had to, in the end, bow to this, although they were cheerfully willing to sell all of their Protestant Loyalists off into the Catholic hands. They had to respect their demands when it came to war. And Northern Ireland got its independence. Northern Ireland remained part of the United Kingdom, while Southern Ireland got its independence. Now, the Irish Republican Army that fought at that time against Britain, and therefore won the independence in that sense, they were re-established under what they called the Provisionals. The Provisional IRA, you would have heard, or the Provos, they were basically imagining themselves to be like the Irish Republican Army of 1916. And they tried to make themselves, in their whole writing, 1916 as the time of the revolution in Ireland, when they rose up unsuccessfully against Britain, but it caused Britain enough grief that they promised them independence after the war if they would just suspend it for the time of the war. And so that's in their dreams, an undefeated army. They were certainly defeated. But you can see how they want to be part of the European Union. They've got something that looks like that. That looks like a Red Star, would you say? And that looks like an AK-47. So you can see where they're coming from. This is a very revolutionary, communist-looking Marxist revolution. It's not just Catholic. It's actually overwhelmingly communist. This is what I saw going around in the Falls Road section of Belfast. This is the Roman Catholic section. Of course, they identify themselves along with the PLO and any other terrorist internationals. This is their kind of propaganda piece where they pretend that they're a real army doing real training. But in fact, they can put on as much camouflage as they like. They're not a real army. They virtually never wear camouflage except at their funerals. But they would normally be just doing assassinations. And so they call themselves the Provisionals, or the People's Army, the POVO. And this is the kind of portraits they will do, always, of course, obscuring the face, because they didn't fight as an army in uniform. They fought like terrorists, murdering people from behind. At the funerals, they will gather like this, wearing sunglasses, wearing masks and hats to prevent themselves from being identified. They'll march in the streets like this during a funeral. The British would normally leave them alone for the funerals, and they could openly use the funerals of any IRA person as a recruiting and propaganda opportunity. And this is the reality that she inherited, the mess that Labour had created. And this is what happens with car bombs. You might be interested to know that when car bombs went off in South Africa, such as in the Church Street bombing, it was the IRA who did them for the ANC. The ANC took the credit, but was the IRA doing a favour for their ANC comrades. So it's not that we were not affected in South Africa by IRA car bombs. We were. They might have called them ANC, but the technical know-how was totally provided by the IRA. This is what happens when you have bombs going off in public places. On this occasion, this was a stock exchange. And car bombs, just the damage. Just imagine, that was an engine block shot up through the sky and came crashing down. Phenomenal damage and loss of life. Here, just one street scene after a car bombing. Just think of the wickedness of spineless cowards who use this kind of tactic. And this, the worst bombing in downtown London by the IRA. Thousands of windows blown out. Massive damage and loss of life. And this is probably the worst in the sense of it's the horrific impact. 7 horses of the Queen's Horse Guards blown to pieces and 4 of the riders killed, many injured and crippled. This poor horse, he became, in fact, I've forgotten his name, Shefton. Shefton was the horse that gripped the whole nation's heart because he was the one survivor. And he is so badly injured, and everyone was determined that he survived, and he did survive. And Shefton became a real hero for the nation, and here he is afterwards. This bombing, 20th July 1982, they have a plaque in memory of the soldiers who died there, and then the memorial for the horses is a water trough for the horses at the site. And so Northern Ireland was an ongoing sore point, and war was absolutely hideous there. When I went to Northern Ireland, this is what I saw around the police stations. This would be a normal police station in Northern Ireland. This is at Falls Road in the Catholic area. So they've got to have grenade shields. If you thought you saw high walls and burglar bars in South Africa, you haven't seen anything until you've been to Northern Ireland. This is what it's like surrounding a police station in Northern Ireland. Notice there's a Catholic area. See the Statue of Mary. You can immediately tell when you're in Falls Road. This is the court, the main police, the main court, where the magistrate sits. Why is it so high? To stop petrol bombs being thrown over. And it's got multiple levels because it's got to stop RPG rockets being fired as well. This is the court. Believe it or not. And that's the back entrance to the court. This is the division between a Catholic neighborhood and a Protestant neighborhood. You want to talk about apartheid? Go to Belfast. This is literally, they called it the peace fence. They've always got a nice name for these things. To keep the Protestant and Catholic apart. You could always tell where you were, whether you were in a Protestant or Catholic area. Here, obviously, was a Protestant area, hence the orange, and the Union Jack, and Long Live the Queen. They were royalists, and they would speak continually of Ulster in a positive way. They have history lessons on the walls of atrocities of the Roman Catholic Church and ethnic cleansing, and what Oliver Cromwell said, that the Roman Catholic Church is not a religion, it's a political power. Until it's crushed, there will be no peace in Ireland. And so, no guesses as to whether the people here are Roman Catholic or Protestant. They make it very clear on their walls. And this is the Parliament of Northern Ireland, Stormont, and the father of the independence of Northern Ireland from the south, who literally threatened the British with war if they would abandon their loyal subjects. Of course, the Catholics would like that statue down. Ian Paisley has been, for the last half century, the most vocal opponent of Catholicism and sellout of Northern Ireland. He's been the one who has mobilized the Protestant forces and he launched the Ulster Union Party when he saw all the other parties were trying to compromise, and he was this subtle, smash Sinn Féin. This was the recruiting poster, and you could tell exactly where they stood. Ian Paisley served for over 40 years as Member of Parliament in the Palace of Westminster in the House of Commons. Now he's in the House of Lords. He was also 25 years in the European Parliament also. This all along with being a minister and open-air preacher and setting up his own denomination that's got over 100 congregations, Bible College and all. Most famous for having disrupted Pope John Paul's speech to the European Parliament with his posters, Pope John Paul II, Antichrist. This is the largest gathering ever in Northern Ireland. Over 250,000 people in Belfast. That's more than the total population of Belfast. At one meeting, this is where Ian Paisley is every Friday, preaching in front of Queen Victoria statue with PA system that can be heard half a mile away. And he had me preaching there too. And so these are some of the firebrands who kept the flames of freedom alive in Northern Ireland in the face of the IRA terrorism. We preach Christ crucified. That's what's behind his pulpit in Martyrs Memorial Church in Belfast. And so this is the Free Presbyterian Church, over 100 congregations. This is one of their synods, a dynamic force started just over 50 years ago by Ian Paisley. Margaret Thatcher declared in the House of Commons, the future of the constitutional affairs of Northern Ireland is a matter for the people of Northern Ireland. This government, this parliament, and no one else. None of the business of the EU or of the IRA or of the Irish government. It's a Northern Ireland and United Kingdom issue. When IRA terrorists imprisoned in Northern Ireland went on a hunger strike to attain the status of political prisoners, Margaret Thatcher refused to budge. These are some of them. Most famous, Bobby Sands, of course, we all know. Find hard to believe he actually fasted 66 days, but anyway. I think a lot of these are, I think they're as fraudulent as Mahatma Gandhi's fast. But, of course, this was a major propaganda coup in the hands of the IRA, and they really promoted it. But Margaret Thatcher said, crime is crime is crime, it's not political. She refused to have a criminal who's murdered innocent people and robbed banks called a political prisoner. And she faced a firestorm of opposition as 9 of the IRA hunger strikers died. But her resolute determination not to be manipulated by opinion polls or political blackmail made the outcome a significant political defeat for the IRA. This really ended up with a complete IRA defeat. She didn't budge. But with over 2 decades of withdrawals and retreats from empire, handing over one overseas territory after another for independence, many assumed the British had passed the military capacity or determination to resist aggression. And so, the ruling military junta, the dictatorship in Argentina, decided to invade the Falkland Islands and South Georgia, 2nd of April, 1982. I remember it because we launched our first frontline mission across the border into Mozambique on the 3rd of April, 1982. And the news just broke out about this invasion, and I was amazed when I came out of Mozambique that the war was on, hot and heavy, and all that happened in my month's absence from the news. But everyone was amazed when Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher dispatched a naval task force to recapture the British overseas territories. Now, this is at the other end of the globe. And they were not facing some small little army. The Argentinians were a very strong force, well-trained. The Air Force was superb. I mean, the British will be the first to admit that. Here's the Argentinian army coming in to Port Stanley. Heavily laden. Of course, you need a lot of winter gear if you're going to sleep in those kind of conditions. But the Empire Strikes Back is how Newsweek described it. Because Margaret Thatcher made it clear the Falklands are British and it's not open for negotiation and Argentina has no right to it. So she made Britain's position very clear by sinking the Argentinian battleship Belgrado by submarine and launching an amphibious and ground combat operation to recapture the islands from the Argentinian military. This is HMS Courageous, one of the British nuclear subs. And they had to sink this battleship because they had no battleship that could compete with the size, and if they're going to go by ship to invade, they needed to be sure that their vessels could survive. And this, the Belgrano, was a serious risk to the British task force. And then in they went. Here's the Falklands, a lot of islands, a huge amount of complex, very unpleasant terrain to get over. You can see the importance of Goose Green. You heard of the Battle of Goose Green, because that's the one little link between this part of the island and that. And of course, the real goal is Port Stanley. Now, Port Stanley, the capital, they're wanting to rename Port Margaret now in honor of Margaret Thatcher. Here you can see the military exclusion ground, the position of the task force. The Belgrano was sighted at that spot, just sunk over here. They believed that it could be a threat to them. British commandos, paratroopers, SAS. What you had was very professional soldiers going in against conscripts. The Argentinians were a fine fighting force, and their navy their air force scored many hits on the Royal Navy. The Royal Navy suffered some hideous losses, and they were scrambling around. One thing that made one respect the Queen was how her one son, Prince Andrew, was involved in one of the helicopter squadrons during that war, and he faced the same danger as everyone else did. He didn't get pulled out, they didn't put him in some safe place. And it's right that the royals have a role in the military, and that's actually been a tradition through the years, and it's something that makes one respect the present Prince Harry and William, that they've done their duty in Afghanistan and Iraq. Whatever we think of those wars, the principle is they've done their duty. Well, the Argentinian Air Force was very accurate, and they really caused tremendous grief to the British forces. As you can see here, this is there's the Antelope hit, the Sheffield was hit. But the British managed to get in, and they made multiple landings, and the SAS and paratroopers, of course, were very professional soldiers with a tremendous amount of experience. And so in many ways, they had a lot of advantage over the Argentinians, whose ground troops were inexperienced, never faced a war before kind of soldiers. But the Argentinians had the advantage of being defenders, and they also had air support from the mainland. But nevertheless, this is how it came down to some of the battles and advances. This is a very difficult battle from a logistical point of view. And one of the interesting things is that when Britain came under this obligation to regain the Falklands, they immediately said to South Africa, oh, can we use Simonstown? Now, this is at a time that South Africa has been sanctioned. Argentina is one of South Africa's few allies. And our military and their military actually were doing joint exercises and some things. And after the British had been giving us no weapons, South Africa, and all of that, the next thing, after blockading Beira and stopping Rhodesia getting fuel, they wanted to use Simonstown as a staging post. Well, South African military wisely said no, because it wasn't our fight, and it really wasn't our business. And while we might have had a lot of sympathy with the British, the point still was, it wasn't our war. And it wasn't right that Simonstown should have been used for this. So I think on that occasion, it gave the British more logistical problems, because all they had was St. Helena, which is not much of an alternative to something as good as Simonstown. So the Navy had a tough time. You can see a lot of these planes were not shot down, but blown up on the airfield by the SAS, which is what the SAS is particularly good at, ground sabotage. And the Royal Marines, who had been humiliated by being defeated by the Argentinians at the beginning, had the honor of raising the flag again over Port Stanley. Argentinian prisoners of war. They took 11,000 Argentinian prisoners of war, and here's piles of Argentinian weapons heaped up. And most of those weapons came from the United States of America, because, of course, Argentina had been American allies. It's actually quite tragic that you had Western countries effectively fighting one another. But it was important that Britain made a stand and showed that they had what it took to resist aggression. Argentina fired the first shots and took first blood. Margaret Thatcher went out here. She's speaking to the head of the land forces and the head of the naval forces. and examining the battle scenes, and especially where many of the British soldiers were buried. They lost some key people, including a colonel from the paratroopers in the Goose Green battle, and she's honoured in the Falkland Islands to this day. They remember her well. This is a recent picture of a Chinook helicopter blown up almost 30 years ago, more than 30 years ago, and that's what you can still see today. HMS Invincible coming back to Britain to great celebrations. This really made it clear that Margaret Thatcher was the Iron Lady. She is willing to fight. She won the next elections by a mile. And in the Falklands, the 10th of January is Margaret Thatcher Day, ever since. And they celebrate it since 1992 as a holiday. 10 years after the liberation of Port Stanley, she went to visit again. This military achievement at the other end of the globe sent shockwaves throughout the Soviet bloc, because it alerted them that the West was not nearly as decadent and as weak as they had imagined. And when on the 12th of October 1984, Margaret Thatcher narrowly escaped assassination in the Brighton hotel bombing during the Conservative Party Congress, she insisted that the conference be opened on time. The next day she made a speech as planned in defiance of the terrorists. Throughout the Cold War, Margaret Thatcher supported the United States President Ronald Reagan's policy of putting freedom on the offensive. She directly supported the anti-communist movements in the Soviet Empire, refusing to provide any more financial loans to the Soviets and their satellites. And that was absolutely critical, because up till then, Germany had always bailed out East Germany when they needed it. America had always bailed out the Soviet Union. Britain was always bailing out Poland and all the others. But now they had to stand firm. Nobody was going to bail out the communists, and they were just going to stew in their own juices and collapse. Instead of the West propping up this corrupt system, which is immoral. And so that was key to bring them down. And Margaret Thatcher's success in reviving the British economy also helped to demonstrate that capitalism had a future, while communism was bankrupting the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. There's the stock exchange down in London. So Margaret Thatcher's role in enabling the West to defeat the Soviet Union and win the Cold War was decisive. It was teamwork. We had to have the South Africans defeating the Cubans in Angola. We had to have the Mujahideen in Afghanistan blooding the Russians' nose there. Had to have the Contras reversing things in Nicaragua. UNITA in Angola, RENAMO in Mozambique. There was many forces on the ground causing trouble in the Soviet Empire. But it was America, Germany, Britain standing together and not allowing the companies and governments to bail out the corrupt communist system. All of this was very helpful. There were other tactics going on behind the scenes too. Communism failed, collapsed. And here you can see examples of people fleeing across from East Germany into West Germany. Checkpoint Charlie, one of the most formidable obstacle courses imaginable. I've smuggled through Checkpoint Charlie. It is very intimidating. We'd have to go through there, we'd be searched and checked on all sorts of things. To smuggle through Checkpoint Charlie was very, very difficult. But this man managed to escape with ingenuity by getting a car that was so low, he put his fiance in the back seat. He's a West Berliner, East Berliner, future mother-in-law in the boot, and they drove out, removed the windscreen and drove out swerving. Now just bear in mind, you're talking about swerving all the way along here with literally bullets flying straight under these barriers into the West and freedom. And the next week someone else did it as well, this man and his fiance. And so they started putting extra barriers down so that nobody could try that one again. This very creative woman was a seamstress, and she made these Russian uniforms and Russian caps for her fiance and his friends, and they liberated a Russian staff car, drove out of Checkpoint Charlie saluting at the gates and into the West and freedom. And the seamstress was under the front seat. This woman found an even more interesting way of escaping inside this cable. And this woman from behind, I don't know how, where is the space behind the radiator in a car, but the ingenuity of people to escape from the socialist workers' paradise. Well, there will be no unity for Europe until there's freedom for Berlin. Germany remains Germany. There remains only one Germany. And the Iron Lady had this to say about the Berlin Wall. The Berlin Wall stands as concrete proof that when people have a choice, they choose to be free. Freedom has its problems, but we've never needed to build walls to keep our people in. And that you can say for South Africa too. We never needed to build walls to keep South Africans in. Maybe to keep others out, because millions poured into this country, wanting to come to what was meant to be the worst country in Africa. People from all of Africa want to come here. People don't flee in the direction of oppression, they flee in the direction of freedom. Despite widespread riots and strikes and other agitation mobilized by the Communist International and by socialists throughout Britain, Margaret Thatcher continued to reduce state intervention, selling off nationalized industries like British Telecom. And one of the big problems was the coal manufacturing. This coal production was now, many of these coal mines were running at a loss and were being subsidized, and just they were keeping these coal mines open just because you didn't want to upset these voters, but they were not only not profitable, they were running at a loss, and they were costing the taxpayer multiplied hundreds of millions. And so a lot of these very unprofitable mines had to be closed. And this led to the biggest clash imaginable, the miners' strike of 1984. This was war. And some called it the enemy within, because the communists had hijacked and totally taken over these trade unions. The trade unions were part of the Communist International, and the Soviets, as part of their Cold War campaign, decided to bring down Margaret Thatcher by mobilizing the miners' strike. And this is absolutely incredible battle. At first it started out fairly friendly, but there was a lot of incendiary speeches by the trade unionists to just rile people up, and they became more and more violent. You had a lot of useful idiots, I think is the way Lenin called them. Thatcher snatched our milk, now she's stealing our bread. She said, we don't need to have the taxpayer paying for free milk for all the kids at school every day, and we don't need to, and she cut a whole lot of things. So the point is, she's starving our kids and stealing our bread and snatching our milk. So that's all very nice emotive terms, but the point is, she's saying this is not the job of the state to steal from other people's hard earnings or taxes and do for, because there was a lot of wastage and things just being thrown away and so on anyway. Well, picket lines, demonstrations, marches, all kinds of being hostile. And then, look at this, just attacking a policeman. Now, the British policemen, the Bobbies, were traditionally known to be unarmed. This kind of thuggery just showed you the mentality of these communist infiltrated trade unions. And so you start to have clashes. And in this case, a whole lot of women were blocking the road to the mine to stop people going in to work at the mines. And others being carried away. And this was a battle. This was ongoing battle. And just look at the amount of police and people getting injured. This was war. And this was a classic communist revolutionary tactic to make the country ungovernable. We know how that works. I mean, they've tried it in us too. But in Britain's case, they responded with more violence than we would have dared in our country. And these people were dragged away and locked up, and they were all prosecuted. This was very much like the battle that Ronald Reagan faced in his first year in power. He had the air traffic controllers strike, and he fired them all and brought in people from the military and took over their jobs, and then started hiring new people and would not hire the ones who went on strike. And because he made his stand, he broke the power of the trade unions. Instead of the trade unions getting something good for the people turned against trade unions, you lost us our jobs. And so, because he wouldn't budge, he said, we can't work on political blackmail. If you demand it in this way by shutting down the country's transport system, then it creates a national emergency, and no, you can't have your jobs back. Well, as it so happens, a whole lot of the miners were very positive to her, because she tried to make the mines that were kept open profitable and better working conditions. But you couldn't keep mines open that weren't covering their own costs. It was immoral. Well, there still remains a very open sore in British history today, people talking about the Great Miners' Strike. But under Margaret Thatcher, inflation in Britain did fall dramatically. Now, I remember in the 1970s, when Britain was a Labour country, if I got £5 note from my aunt in England, it only got about $3.70 in Rhodesian dollars, because the British pound was weaker than the Rhodesian dollar. weaker than the South African rand. The British pound in the 70s was not very good at all. It was going down, down, down. And today, if you think, the British pound is, what, 13, 14 rand to dollar?
Yeah.
Well, back before Margaret Thatcher, the rand was stronger than the pound. That tells you something right then. And, of course, the dollar, the rand has plummeted since then. She strengthened the pound enormously so that the pound became a real hard currency again. And Margaret Thatcher is also renowned for resisting all pressures to integrate Britain into the European Union. Britain is a Viking state. Like all the Viking countries of Scandinavia, it has the cross in it. Not only the cross of St. George, but the cross of St. Andrew. And it's a monarchy. If you make Britain a province of the European Union, then the Queen becomes what? Just a chief. I mean, you've lost the sovereignty of Britain. And in Britain, the constitutional authority resides in the Queen or King as head of state. And they have a constitutional monarchy with an elected parliament as well. And that cannot be operational under Brussels. Bureaucrats in Brussels, as she calls it. She resisted all pressures to abolish the pound and bring Britain to Euro common currency, which the Labour Union said they were going to do, and if she hadn't taken over, the pound would have been abolished and it would have been part of the Euro. From the start, she asserted British sovereignty and opposed all EU encroachment. At Bruges in Belgium in 1988, Margaret Thatcher made a powerful speech in which she outlined her opposition to all proposals for the European Economic Community to become a federal structure, what is today called the European Union. She said no to the EU. This is meant to be limited to free trade and effective competition. She opposed any centralization which eroded the sovereignty of Great Britain, and she succeeded in keeping Britain out of the Eurozone. And I think many people are grateful for that right now. Margaret Thatcher is also the leading international advocate of constructive engagement with South Africa during the 1980s. When people were joining the bandwagon to put sanctions on South Africa and disinvestment, she was the most forthright opponent of all economic sanctions against South Africa. She argued that a prosperous society would be the most receptive to positive change. And therefore, if you want to help the people in South Africa, help them by investing, not disinvesting. Disinvesting is going to bring about ruin and economic chaos. Today, a lot of what people blame on apartheid should be blamed on anti-apartheid. Because who caused the breakdown of the economy? The economy was growing in the 70s and 80s at 8%. South Africa's economy is strong, powerful, one of the strongest currencies in the world. But it was the sanctions and the riots and the strikes and the boycotts and the burning of 3,000 schools by the UDF and ANC and getting disinvestment. That's what created the lost generation of 5 million children who didn't get an education because no education before liberation. And so those poor kids today, all they can be is what? Beggars and thieves. They can't be employed. They're unemployable. All they were taught to do is how to make petrol bombs and throw rocks. Who's going to employ someone like that? And that's not the creation of apartheid. That's the creation of the anti-apartheid movement, the ANC and UDF and the Southern Council churches. They're the ones to blame for the burned schools, the boycotted classes, the broken relationships, the trade that was lost, the millions of jobs that were lost at that time, and the bringing of the economy down and chasing away investors who would have been investing in the country otherwise. So Margaret Thatcher's been proven dead right. Interesting enough, the ANC uses the same arguments today that she used to argue against sanctions on Zimbabwe. They said, no, but if you put sanctions on... And nobody's spoken about sanctions on Zimbabwe. They're talking about sanctions selected to Mugabe and his top leaders. It's not sanctions on the country. They're giving aid to the country. It's just sanctions on the corrupt crooks of leaders who are bankrupting the country. But they keep arguing the same arguments that Margaret Thatcher used at the time, which is disinvestment is not the way, sanctions are not the way, investment is the way. You lift up people's economic standards, you will increase their political freedom. Margaret Thatcher transformed Britain in the 1980s. It's very rare that any person has affected history as much as Margaret Thatcher has, but she really did turn the tide and she changed the country with a dedication to free markets, and she became a critical ally and ideological soulmate of Ronald Reagan in the Cold War against Soviet communism. And they really got on together. They were best friends in many ways. Remember, this is the time of the Soviet Union at the height of its power. They had taken 13 countries just during Jimmy Carter's reign, just actually handed over to them on a platter, including countries like Rhodesia. And of course, we're not even talking about Iran, betrayed in the hands of the Ayatollah. But the culminative results of strong Western governments, defeats for the Soviets, the fact that all their empire was rebelling, and the fact that in Angola they were losing, and in Afghanistan they were losing, in Mozambique they were losing, in Nicaragua they were losing, the communist empire was in trouble, and in Poland there were huge protests, and solidarity was shutting down the country and showing that the communists were completely unpopular. Revolution in the streets in Romania and all throughout the Eastern Bloc, you saw the communist satellites toppling. And this is the fruit of the Cold War raged by Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, P.W. Porter, Helmut Kohl, RENAMO, UNITA, Contras, many different groups, all played a part in bringing down the Soviet Union and reuniting Germany, removing the Iron Curtain, and seeing the removal of thousands of idols. These statues of Lenin and Karl Marx were sliced and diced and shipped off to the junkyards where they belonged. Here's Margaret Thatcher receiving a hero's welcome in Moscow in 1990. In an interview with Human Events in 1996, Margaret Thatcher declared, "The biblical basis affects one's whole worldview, one's attitude and outlook. The notion of human rights comes from the sanctity of the individual. The Ten Commandments are addressed to each and every person. This is the origin of our common humanity and of the sanctity of the individual. Each one of us has a duty to try to carry out those commandments. You don't get that in any other political creed. It isn't merely about democracy and liberty. It's about personal liberty with personal responsibility. Responsibility to your parents, to your children, to your God. This really binds us together in a way that nothing else does. If you accept freedom, you have to have principles about responsibility. You cannot do this without a biblical foundation. Today, people are trying democracy, but they look at it as a philosophy or political pattern without understanding its roots. Liberty's roots are the Bible. I'm afraid democracy's fundamental religious roots are weakening. There are some countries, fortunately, kept alive by faithful people, but even they are tending to weaken. In the British system, children are taught Christianity. They're taught to have faith in schools. It is a compulsory subject. In my day, the schools were places where children learned the great hymns which stayed with them the rest of their lives. Hymns, prayers, Bible readings, it is really all locked together. Education starts with the Bible. It is a foundation of all good education. Margaret Thatcher is the one who started the principle of reports being sent out not just on the students, but on the teachers, the principal, and the schools. But the parents, the ratepayers, and those that pay school fees, got a report on how the school compared with other schools in their district, how the teachers compared with other teachers in their district, how the principal compared. Said, why should you just get reports on how your child fed? We need reports on... She said, competition is good in the marketplace, and it's good in education too. The state shouldn't have a monopoly of anything, let alone education. These things, the Bible, hymns, prayer, these passed into our bloodstreams, even if your parents are not practicing Christians, because through the schools you got Christianity. It is important that people realize that history is an enormous, great, and wonderful story of fantastic efforts of man in the face of great adversity. In the last days, Margaret Thatcher would have met here regularly. This is the committee room for the House of Lords. Notice they have the red upholstery for the House of Lords, as you have the green upholstery for the House of Commons. And up behind, you've got Moses coming down the mountain with the Ten Commandments, the foundation of all law. And here you have the children of Israel coming out of Egypt. These are the huge wall murals, which are to inspire them as they decide on laws. By looking at history this way, you see how men never lost faith, no matter how terrible things were. Concerning the erosion of traditional marriage, Margaret Thatcher stated, "Today I'm particularly concerned about the number of marriages that break up and the numbers of children born to single mothers. This is the greatest threat of all. Those numbers have gone up from 1950. For centuries before that, it stayed about the same. These things did happen, to some single mothers, which is only about 5% of births. In the post-war period, mothers were provided with houses or flats and incomes. We hoped that this would help the children, but what we've done by this is not to relieve the problem, but to multiply the problem. Today, 30% of children, she's talking about in England, are born to single mothers. I know it's more than that in our country. We also find the criminality factor is much higher in children with single mothers for the reason they've never been brought up with a stable background in a supportive environment. If there is one thing I cannot stand, it is cruelty or abuse of children. It is the worst kind. It was in the New Testament that our Lord said, anyone who harms these little ones deserves to have a millstone tied around his neck and to be sunk in the deepest sea. You can see why she wasn't too popular with the press. Socialists cry power to the people and raise their clenched fist as they say it. We all know what they really mean, power over people, power to the state. Defeat, I don't recognize the meaning of the word. In order to be considered truly free, countries must also have a deep love of liberty. That's why you can't have freedom in the Middle East as long as Islam remains the primary religion, can you? Islam, this Arab Spring has led to greater oppression and exploitation and violence than it ever was before. They don't have the biblical base. Being powerful is like being a lady. If you have to tell people you aren't. A real lady doesn't have to say she's a lady, and someone who's powerful doesn't have to say they're powerful. She's talking about countries here. You may have to fight a battle more than once to win it. You don't have to accept defeat. The trouble with socialism is that eventually you run out of other people's money. And I will go on criticizing socialism and opposing socialism because it is bad for Britain. And Britain and socialism are not the same thing. It's not the creation of wealth that is wrong, but love of money for its own sake. There can be no liberty unless there's economic liberty. We want a society where people are free to make choices, to make mistakes, to be generous and to be compassionate. There's a big difference between voluntary Christian generosity and compulsory communist confiscation. Margaret Thatcher declared, if you set out to be liked, you'll be prepared to compromise on anything at any time, and you will achieve nothing. And that is an important principle. You cannot be popular and principled at the same time. Standing in the middle of the road is very dangerous. You get knocked down by the traffic from both sides. When people say, you know, they're taking a middle of the road position, that was their answer. You stand in the middle of the road, you're going to get run down. If you want something said, ask a man. If you want something done, ask a woman. I think a lot of the men in Britain were wimps. And it's like in the time of the judges, God raised up Deborah because the men were wimps. Shame on them. People think at the top there isn't much room. They tend to think of it like Everest. My message is there's tons of room at the top. In other words, aspire for greatness. Aim for more. Don't follow the crowd, let the crowd follow you. In my opinion, Margaret Thatcher stands out as Great Britain's finest and most successful prime ministers ever. And the moment I made that comment in the press, I had people saying, well, what about Winston Churchill? My answer is, well, what about Winston Churchill? He bankrupted the British Empire, lost the British Empire on an unnecessary war. He backed the wrong side. He saved the Soviet Union. He destroyed Britain. Britain was wrecked. Absolutely wrecked. It was poorer and more bankrupt after. The world was not a better place after Churchill's war than it was before. Britain didn't have to be involved in the First World War. Britain didn't need to give this unsolicited guarantee of do what you want to Poland, which guaranteed the Second World War. They didn't have to declare war on Germany. They didn't have to keep fighting after Dunkirk. What Winston Churchill did might make good propaganda for some filmmakers, but honestly and truly, it was bad for Britain. What Margaret Thatcher did was good for Britain and for the world. What Churchill did was bad for Britain, bad for Europe, bad for the whole world. The world is a worse place off because of the Second World War, and it became the Second World War when Britain got involved in it. So, in my opinion, Margaret Thatcher is 100 times better than Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill might have made some great speeches. There's a lot of tremendous quotes he made, but his policies were terrible. When asked what motivated her interest in politics, Margaret Thatcher said, I cannot bear Britain in decline. I cannot. She, more than anybody else in the 20th century, reversed that decline. You cannot point to any other leader of Britain in the 20th century who reversed a decline. She's the only one I can see. All the others assisted Britain in its decline and went further down, further down. Britain started the 20th century at the top, the superpower of superpowers, the greatest power in the whole world. And Britain's just gone down through the 20th century. But Margaret Thatcher is the one individual who reversed that trend, the only one. Charles Krauthammer, a commentator in America, said Margaret Thatcher single-handedly saved the country from socialism. Together with just a few others, including Ronald Reagan, she helped to bury communism forever. That's one person's commentary. I must say that it is for a new generation to take up her principles and her policies and work to rescue a great nation from greater threats than it's ever faced before. If anyone thinks, phew, well, all the threats are in the past. No, Britain's still facing terror bombings, now from Muslims. Now they're being invaded by Muslims. And they tell us Islam is freedom. But it's just freedom to beat your wives, which is why they have the burqa. And they've got the audacity to ask for Sharia for Britain. They dare to desecrate the flag and to scream their hate in England. And on the 11th of November to bring up posters saying, our dead on paradise, your dead on hell. British soldiers burn hell. Think of that. Bring that out when people are grieving the loss of loved ones. Europe is the cancer, Islam is the answer. Exterminate those who slander Islam. This is outside the House of Parliament in England. This is the tolerance of Islam. Freedom go to hell. Well, that's eloquent. And yet, what does the British media say? They say nothing about kill whitey and honor killings, rock and deaths of infidels and all that. But the real problem is people who wear Union Jack shirts and who bring up their kids to love their country and love the Lord. I mean, that's the problem. We've got to stamp out this patriotic English character. But don't you dare say anything negative about these mass murdering, hateful thugs. Now notice, this is from Australia. Notice how the Australians protest and notice how the Muslims protest. Can you see the difference? These people are intolerant. These people are tolerant. Correct? Mm. That's the way it is. Welcome to Ireland. Or is it Nigeria? Who knows anymore? And so they say anti-racist is now a code word for anti-white. Brave person bring this one out. Yeah. Here's what the Norwegian Defence League says. We refuse to trade this for this. This is the new multicultural Islamic or Islamization of Europe. Islam, the religion of peace, killed at least 80 million Hindus, 10 million Buddhists and 60 million Christians. Yeah. Islam is as peaceful and tolerant as there are good spellers.
Forgive them, for they know not what they do.
Somebody wrote this: Muslims are not happy in Gaza or Egypt. They're not happy in Libya or Morocco. They're not happy in Iran and Iraq and Yemen and Afghanistan. They're not happy in Syria or Pakistan or Lebanon. Where are they happy? They're happy in Australia and Canada and England, France and Italy, and Germany and Sweden, America, Norway, Denmark, Holland. Basically, they're happy in any country that isn't Muslim, and unhappy in every country that is Muslim. And who do they blame? They don't blame Islam. They don't blame their leadership. They certainly don't blame themselves. No, they blame the countries that they're happy in. And then they want to change those countries to be like the countries where they came from, where they were unhappy. Mm-hmm. Sharia for the UK. Islam is using freedom and tolerance to destroy freedom and tolerance. As it so happens, I have a personal reason to be grateful to the Iron Lady. In October 1987, when I and three other frontline missionaries were arrested and imprisoned in Zambia, Margaret Thatcher personally intervened, spoke up for us, and secured our release. We were travelling through Botswana and Zambia to Malawi to enter Mozambique, and we were arrested in Zambia, thrown into stinking, disgusting disease factory, the Sarka Central Prison, and we'd been arrested at Kazangulu Ferry for refusing to bribe Zambian officials. We spent excruciating weeks of abuse at the hands of Zambian security forces in filthy cells, overcrowded, 50, 60 people in a single cell, 10 feet by 15 feet each. No running water, no sanitation, just disgusting, no electricity. We were interrogated, we were incarcerated and abused in Lusaka Central Prison. But friends of ours ensured that the British Prime Minister was informed of our plight just before her departure for the Commonwealth Conference in Vancouver. Now, the Commonwealth, which we used to call the Commonwealth in Rhodesia, seemed to have only one unifying purpose at that stage, and that was anti-South Africa. Before that, they had two unifying purposes, anti-Rhodesia and anti-South Africa. But now Rhodesia was Zimbabwe, so now the only thing that unified these creeps, which is just a big gang of unelected dictators primarily. And the leader there of the frontline state, so-called, was Kenneth Kaunda, dictator of Zambia. And he subjected Margaret Thatcher to haranguing that Britain was refusing to place economic sanctions on South Africa. Margaret Thatcher responded by asking why Zambia herself doesn't place sanctions on South Africa. Mm-hmm. You're a lot closer. Kaunda responded that would place many people out of work. Exactly, responded the British Prime Minister. And as South Africa is one of our most important trading partners, many British citizens would be placed out of work if I was to impose sanctions on South Africa. Quite aside from many South Africans themselves would be placed out of work. She then went out to relate how Zambians were dependent on South African maize grown in the Orange Free State, how Zambian Airways was maintained by South African Airways, Zambian Railways was maintained by South African Railways, South African veterinarians cared for Zambian cattle. Many Zambians were migrant workers in South Africa, and she named how many hundreds of millions of pounds a year went into Zambian national coffers as a result of those migrant labourers. Kenneth Kaunda then declared that because of South Africa's human rights abuses, Britain should impose sanctions. It was at this point that Margaret Thatcher produced our information. Who are you to speak about human rights abuses? She challenged Kaunda. Four British missionaries are being held without trial as presidential detainees in Lusaka Central Prison, tortured and abused by your own security forces. Well, that finished the debate. Kenneth Kaunda was dumbstruck, speechless, humiliated. He ordered our immediate release. The first words he said when he came off his plane in Lusaka was, "Get those missionaries out of here." And we were set free. Prison doors were opened and we were set free. And many good things came out of their imprisonment. One of the people I met in prison, General Godfrey Mianda, he ended up being Minister of Education and later Deputy President. And General Godfrey Mianda got us into many of the teacher training colleges to run biblical worldview seminars, and a lot of great things happened. And he's the one who challenged me to write biblical principles for Africa. I took him a whole line of big, thick, heavy books and I handed to him when he was Minister of Education. He groaned and he said, "I love reading, I love books, but the demands of office give me very little time to read. Don't you have a small book that summarizes all of these?" So I thought, well, that's a challenge. So I wrote Biblical Principles for Africa, which got expanded and translated, and we've distributed well over 26,000 all over Africa, and Zambian government, Malawi government promoted it, Zambian president, Malawi president, put endorsements that we've got on the back of the book. So we can thank him for that. We can thank Margaret Thatcher for our freedom. I'm only one of many people who has a deep debt of gratitude to Margaret Thatcher. She deserves our deep gratitude and our enduring respect. And so the Union Jack is at half mast now. She will have a state funeral at St. Paul's Cathedral, full military honours. And Baroness Thatcher will be honoured. They are talking about putting a statue to her in Trafalgar Square and renaming Port Stanley Port Margaret in the Falkland Islands. There are different books on Margaret Thatcher, and I would say the best though is her own biography, The Downing Street Years. There's two books. She wrote that first, and then she wrote another one on the years that led up to being in power. So she starts us with the day she came into power in 1979. We must win Europe back to Christ. Europe must not be allowed to become Eurabia, cannot be allowed to be secularized. We've got to know our history, we've got to understand our history, and so at the Reformation Society we've been dealing with all these kind of issues, that we could understand propaganda, understand history, understand how victorious Christians have changed the world in the past and what we can do to follow these examples of excellence. And so these are some of the resources we've produced. If anyone wants to borrow my book on Margaret Thatcher, you'd be welcome. I think it's outstanding. I haven't read many political biographies. I've just read The Great Betrayal by Ian Smith and this one. They are two of the few politicians that I'd respect. I would also have to add Ian Paisley, of course, as one of the politicians I've met that I respect and honour. And P.W. Botha, also a great leader at a great time when we were fighting communism, and he gave our army, in fact, a lot of the resources and opportunities and the go-ahead to win some of the greatest victories across the border. At the heart of our enemy is actually Satan. Karl Marx was a Satanist, and if you haven't read this book, Marx and Satan by Richard Wurmbrand, well worth it. You do not understand communism until you understand its deep and abiding hatred for God. And the fact that there are Christian communists should not deter you. There are oxymorons out there like that, is they do not understand the heart of communism. But the heart of communism is hatred for God. And the fact that some Christians have been fooled into adopting it is as foolish as those Christians who are theistic evolutionists. So, any questions, any comments?
Margaret Thatcher was a Methodist, wasn't she?
Yes, she was, indeed. Mm. I was interested that the Methodist Church put out a lukewarm statement of regret. They obviously didn't like her policies, but she was a faithful, lifelong Methodist. Mm. I think the Methodist conference might not be too thrilled with all of her positions, because they'd compromise and she didn't. But I know where John Wesley would stand. He would not be standing with the present Methodist conference. I thought this person here imbibed a lot of what Margaret Thatcher taught. We're living in a nation now where doctors destroy health, where lawyers destroy justice, where universities destroy knowledge, governments destroy freedom, the press destroys information, religion destroys morals, and our banks destroy the economy. And that's what you've got to fight to. It's a total assault against civilization itself. And this, I think, is a principle which very much was epitomized by Margaret Thatcher. Fight for the truth, even if you feel like you're fighting alone, because actually you're not. If God is with you, then you're not alone.